inquiry into last year's mosque attack in New Zealand blames authorities for ignoring repeated warnings from the Muslim community regarding escalating hate crimes. The U.S. announces a new arms sales package to Taiwan, the sixth this year, adding to existing tensions with China. Also in the headlines, Indian farmers protest in New Delhi amid a nationwide strike against new agricultural laws that they say could destroy their livelihoods. Thanks for joining us. A New Zealand inquiry into last year's mosque attacks in Christchurch has criticized authorities for ignoring repeated warnings from the Muslim community on rising hate crimes against them. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said that her government would act on a proposal for the police to better identify, record, and respond to hate crimes. She admitted that spy agencies failed to focus enough on the threat from far-right terrorists in the run-up to the Christchurch attack. In response to the inquiry, the Muslim Association of Canterbury, where the attack took place, called for an end to state agencies' bias against Muslims.
We've known for a long time that the Muslim community has been unfairly targeted with hate speech and hate crimes. This report shows that we were right. The report shows that institutional prejudice and unconscious bias exists in the government agencies and that needs to change.
The attack saw a gunman open fire at two mosques in Christchurch in mid-March last year. The white supremacists shot at worshippers, including women and children, during Friday prayers. 51 people were killed as a result. Abdul Razak is the chairman of the Fiance Royal Commission Committee, who joins us from Wellington. Welcome. So this piece of news is actually... It should fall below the bigger picture, and that is the way that bias against Muslims exists. The ideas that are formed against Muslims obviously is through misinformation, whether it's through the media, movies, or through some cultures that actually promote anti-Islam sentiment. That's what is at the core. How can these issues actually be dealt with?
Well, let me be a bit more specific in terms of the New Zealand context. The Federation, the FIANS, we produced a report, which was called the Seminal Report by the Royal Commission. In that report, after 7 months of investigation, we found significant anomalies in the way the gun licensing law was applied, whereby this person, this terrorist, was able to get hold of a gun. The New Zealand specification is that a person has to be vetted and the reference has to be given by a family member. Instead, the New Zealand police relied on two gaming friends online, which is totally beyond the scope of the New Zealand regulations. And for that, the police commissioner apologized today officially. On the other side, we found that the National Security Intelligence Agency and the whole security apparatus here in New Zealand was totally focused on what we call Islamic extremism, at the exclusion of the right-wing extremism, which was actually taking hold all over the world. They totally ignored the international threat scape of the right-wing extremists in Europe, in America, and also in Australia and in other parts of the world. They were exclusively focusing on the Muslim extremists, to the point that they were made fictitious sort of issues about jihadi brides going from New Zealand and so on and so forth. This is something which we actually complained about. It was also one in our report, that there was an over-concentration of the NZSIS resources on looking at Muslims and Muslims only, rather than the other. And this is what the Royal Commission also agreed with, and this is what also the Prime Minister agreed with, for which the SIS Director General apologized to the Muslims, and as you know, the Prime Minister has also apologized. So the Royal Commission was actually a very robust and a very thorough process, where they went through a lot more information that we had at our disposal, and they came to the same conclusion. And in terms of recommendations as a result of that, there are some significant changes taking place. First of all, in terms of the security agency, there's going to be a new security agency. There's going to be more engagement with civil society, particularly the minorities, including the Muslims and others. And in terms of national intelligence priorities, we will now have a say in terms of the discussions of the priority, as opposed to be a closed door exercise by our intelligence services.
Well, I'm looking at your initial suggestions from the FIANS as posted on the website. One of the things that I'd like to find out from you is in the preamble, number two, it says that a Muslim should be included in the Royal Commission composition. Is that going to happen, or is that the case right now?
Oh, yes. We had what you're looking at is was actually from last year when we were actually looking at the whole Royal Commission itself. Yes, apart from Muslims being as part of the Royal Commission, we were we engaged with them. They had a Muslim reference group. In other words, we were part of the process part of the reference group, as they call it. In addition to that, as chairman of the FIANS, I had monthly meetings with the Royal Commissioners, getting updates and also not specific updates in terms of national sensitive issues, but updates in terms of what they were doing, and we were also able to contribute. So there was a very, very, grassroots engagement with the community.
And finally and quickly, when you take a look at the atmosphere that prevailed after this massacre, which was really quite shocking, obviously, in its depth and scope, and up to this day, do you think that the value of Muslims, the way that Muslims are looked at, it has changed and in any shape or form? Because as we know, the terrorists who committed this heinous act targeted Muslims while they were praying. So my question is, have people then looked at Muslims differently and paid more respect to what has happened?
I must, first of all, qualify. This terrorist wasn't a New Zealander. In New Zealand, we say it's green, clean, and safe, and has been until this Australian terrorist came into this country and did what he did. I would say after the March 15th, you saw the absolute outpouring of the whole of grief, of closeness, what they call aroha, love, by the New Zealanders, and led by our Prime Minister, and you saw her, she referred to this as you are us approach. In other words, an inclusive approach. So as far as New Zealand society is concerned, they're very welcoming of Muslims. They're very receptive to diversity. They can be more so, and that's what this whole report was all about. However, there has been institutional bias and institutional Islamophobia and what we call securitization of Islam. These are the challenges facing some of the structures within the country, particularly in the public service, and these are the ones which this Royal Commission addressed, and inshallah there will be some significant positive changes in that direction.
Thank you very much. A pleasure talking to you, Abdur Razak, Chairman of the FIANS Royal Commission Committee. Many thanks. Moving on, the U.S. has approved the new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million amid tensions with China. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. The State Department says the sale is aimed at helping improve the security of Taiwan. The move is expected to spark a strong criticism from China that considers Taiwan as its own territory. The U.S. under President Donald Trump has finalized 11 weapons deals with the island. Washington has announced $5.1 billion in arms sales this year alone. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen says the island faces daily military threats from what she has described as authoritarian forces. An independent China strategist Andrew Leung says the U.S. arms sales to Taiwan are part of its policy to push back against China.
The process is supported by the Taiwan Relations Act in the United States, under which the United States government is empowered to strengthen China's Taiwan defenses against perceived kind of threats from the mainland. So I think that this is likely to be a new normal, because Taiwan is regarded by the United States as an unsinkable aircraft carrier to push back against China's perceived acts of coercion, for example, in the Taiwan Strait. So I think that we can expect this to continue. In Beijing, there is already a national law enacted a number of years ago preventing this from happening, and backing up against this law, against separatism or open declaration of independence, some military deployment of missiles aircraft carriers and naval forces. So Taiwan knows it. There is no match in this military strength of Taiwan compared with China. The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope, is trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Indian farmers have staged a one-day nationwide strike as part of their efforts to make the government repeal its new agriculture laws. Farmers have pledged to block major roads and rail lines across India for several hours. The government has boosted security across the country. Tens of thousands of farmers have already been camped to the outskirts of the capital since November 27 to protest the laws. The legislation opens up trade in agricultural produce. The farmers say that it will help major firms take over the agriculture industry and force down prices. The Indian government argues that the changes are needed for the future of the industry. Several rounds of talks have failed to narrow differences between the two sides. Earlier we spoke to Harsh Mander, who is the director of the Center for Equity Studies. He said that India's agriculture is in crisis, and the government's new reforms are worsening the situation.
Indian agriculture has been in a very intense crisis for at least 20 years. Now we have literally hundreds of thousands of farmers who are committing suicide. There's the whole technological, ecological, marketing, everything is in a crisis, and the large majority of farmers are small and marginal farmers. But what there have been a number of commissions which have said that basically farming is no longer an economically viable activity and it needs significant amounts of support from the state. And that is what they were expecting and hoping, particularly after the lockdown and the level of distress that existed. Instead, what these three laws have done, and they passed them firstly as ordinances even without debate, is largely opening up agriculture suddenly to big multinational corporations who would then control what farmers would produce, what prices they would be paid. Because today there's a monopoly of the state actually purchasing these producers and having a baseline price.
Britain has begun mass vaccination against the coronavirus, becoming the first Western country to do so. First in line for vaccination are the most vulnerable people. They include the over 80s, care home workers, as well as frontline health and social care staff. Britain is planning to vaccinate 2 million people by the end of the year and more in 2021. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that this is a huge step towards the UK's fight against COVID-19. The country is one of the worst hit nations by the virus in the world. It has over 61,000 deaths out of more than 1.6 million infections. European Union foreign ministers have adopted a plan aimed at making the 27-nation bloc less dependent on the U.S., the United Kingdom, and China. The ministers argue that the chaotic presidency of Donald Trump has highlighted the necessity for such a move. Jerome Hughes has more.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, There are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit by war.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Senior Iranian security official says the U.S. seeks to reinforce and expand terror cells of Daesh in the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, also said that Washington is trying to loot Syria's oil and ensure the security of Israel. He told visiting Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Baghdad that the U.S.'s evil presence in the region must end. Shamkhani called on the international community to counter atrocities committed by Tel Aviv. He said that a world without Israel would be a safer place. He further praised Syria's pivotal role in standing up to Israel's occupation and expansionism. The top Syrian diplomat in turn appreciated Iran's all-out support for his country against terrorism and Israeli threats. The United States is reportedly mulling over blacklisting Yemen's Ansarullah movement, which has been resisting a years-long Saudi-backed war. Various advocacy groups and human rights organizations have criticized the plan, warning that it would deal a severe blow to relief efforts in the war-stricken nation.
War, famine, and disease. Just a few crises Yemen has been dealing with in over 5 years. That war broke out in the Arab country, aimed at bringing the government of former President Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. In the meantime, the United States is reportedly considering designating Ansarullah, which has been resisting the Saudi-led aggression, as a terrorist group. Oman's Foreign Minister Sayed Badr al-Busaidi said the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State mentioned the possibility during a visit to Muscat. The development came a day after the United Nations and international aid agencies warned Washington against the plan, citing concerns that the move would prevent life-saving aid from reaching the war-wracked country and would derail a related $700 million relief program.
Well, the major problem, of course, aside from the fact that the designation is completely, you know, uncalled for, it's unfair and unjust, for the basic reason that Ansarullah is not engaged in any terrorist attacks whatsoever and cannot in any way, shape, or form be considered a terrorist organization. They have never instigated an unprovoked attack against civilian targets in any country, neither in Yemen itself nor in nations abroad. And even the attacks on Saudi territory that they are being blamed for are legitimate military retaliations against a conflict that has been enforced upon them by Saudi Arabia.
David Beasley, executive director of the UN's World Food Program, told the Washington Post Daily newspaper earlier this week that a designation could hamper aid deliveries. Beasley's warning came following his meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which he expressed grave concerns about the blacklisting of Ansarullah.
Turkey has detained nearly 200 people in connection with a failed coup in 2016. The detentions follow arrest warrants issued in 50 provinces. Active duty military personnel are among those targeted. The detainees are suspected of having links to U.S.-based opposition figure Fethullah Gulen. The Turkish government accuses him of orchestrating the attempted coup. Gulen denies any involvement. Since the failed putsch, tens of thousands of people have been jailed, suspended, or sacked from their jobs. Critics say the Turkish government is using the failed coup as an excuse to crack down on dissidents. Ankara says the measures are necessary to maintain national security. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we have been discussing Imam Khomeini's teaching method for a couple of weeks. One of the most important features of Imam Khomeini's teaching method was that he observed the respect of ulama in various fields of Islamic sciences. Although he had a very critical spirit, as we had discussed earlier, he never allowed his students to disrespect other ulama and great figures, no matter if they were alive or dead. Today, we will touch upon this aspect of his personality. Stay tuned, please. Ayatollah Muhammad Emomi Kashani says, Imam Khomeini used to keep high esteem for ulama and jurisprudence and remember them very respectfully. When he wanted to reject the remarks on jurisprudence, principles of jurisprudence and philosophy, he would do it with respect. For example, he would not say, that a scholar has not realized this or has not paid attention to this. Late Hujjatul Islam Mustafa Zamani also said, whenever the Imam wanted to quote a subject from a scholar, he would remember him with respect, and if he didn't accept the subject, he would mention it with special respect, and then would reject it with scientific argumentation. Yet, he would sometimes use the phrase, Rizwanullah ta'ala alayh, meaning, may God be satisfied with him, for the scholar. He would reject the special respect for the writer, even the books that he thought were not usable for higher levels of jurisprudence. Another aspect of Imam Khomeini's teaching method was that he taught very attractively, smoothly, and expressively. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Fazil Lankarani narrated an interesting memory on this, saying, Imam Khomeini's way of expression in teaching was so sweet and expressive that nobody needed to ask another one to explain the Imam's view. He would directly present all subjects with his sweet and clear expression. Imam Khomeini would use special phrases and appropriate examples on abstract issues to elucidate them for students. Ayatollah Jafar Subhani, one of the present sources of emulation, says in this regard, the Imam's general teaching method or his speech was in a way that he would refrain from complicated speaking and try to deliver intellectual and theoretical issues, which are often far-fetched for understanding with the clearest phrases and evident examples. He would even explicate rational and intellectual issues which are beyond senses and materials in the form of examples. Thus, his teaching and remarks had a special attraction in the seminary, and few could say that he had not benefited from the Imam's course, provided that he had the talent to learn that course. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Kamal Faqih Imani also says, Imam Khomeini was very powerful in making the students understand courses. This caused students and ulema to attend his classes, and the Salmasi Mosque would be crowded so much so that sometimes it would extend to the alley. Dear listeners, another aspect of Imam Khomeini's classes was that he was not rigid and used to tell jokes for refreshment of students. Late Hujjatul Islam Ali Dawani narrated this interesting memory. Although Imam Khomeini was very tacit, he would say a joke at the class so that the audience would laugh loudly. While he was indifferent and silent as if he had not said anything. For instance, one of his students from Azerbaijan area insisted on his opinion and the Imam wanted to silence him. At last, Imam Khomeini told him, "Yok," meaning no in Turkish. In this way, both that student and the audience laughed and he was silent. Imam Khomeini sometimes would even joke with his elder son, Haja Mustafa, to refresh the class, although he deemed high respect for his scientific status. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abdul Majid Irawani says, "One day in Holy Najaf, late Haja Mustafa, who was a great mujtahid and a scholar, raised a question on a hadith. The Imam answered him, but his son was not convinced and asked for more explanation. The Imam said jokingly, 'Don't say such things, lest people laugh saying that you are illiterate.' Aga Mustafa said loudly, 'They will say I am your son. If I am illiterate, I am your son.' Scientific courage and self-confidence were other aspects of Imam Khomeini's teaching method. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Zanjani said, among the features of Imam Khomeini's class was his broad-mindedness that he used to enforce at his courses. Therefore, the students would get used to it. He would let different views be raised in the course of teaching so that the students were exposed to various views and reach a desirable conclusion. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat said, Imam Khomeini created such a change in the seminary of Najaf that attracted us to him. Till then, the remarks of great jurisprudence used to be considered as a sacred domain. For example, if we said this is the view of late Ayatollah Naini, it would be considered as the last argument, since the personality of scholars had such a great impact on views. This had turned jurisprudence from a matter of research into a matter of imitation. Thus, students would not dare raise a view against the view of great figures. But Imam Khomeini caused a change and taught to the students to research on the views of great scholars. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini used to think a lot, although he was a very great researcher. Ayatollah Sobhani says that once he had given several books on a specific topic, but the Imam kept only two of them and said that he had to contemplate to find the answer. Another element of Imam Khomeini's success in teaching method was that he would avoid prolixity. He used to express his view in the shortest and most useful possible way. Professor Ghulam Reza Awani says, one of the characteristics of Imam Khomeini's works and books was his succinctness. I mean that there is no room for prolixity in his books. The Imam mentions an issue and discusses it briefly. He usually quotes the words of all his teachers on an issue and then mentions his view. Dear listeners, next time we will dwell upon another aspect of Imam Khomeini's teaching method. God bless.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kaveh Tahweh. Venezuela's free and fair parliamentary elections have been held. The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's governing Socialist Party has regained control of the National Assembly and is now called to chart a path towards national reconciliation, amongst other things. Now, major opposition groups, including the one led by the U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido, boycotted the vote, calling it a fraud. In this debate, we will look at why the West, particularly the EU and the U.S., have not called this a free and fair election, while backing the self-proclaimed president and opposition leader, Juan Guaido. Joining us for this debate is Professor of International Studies at Unicinos, Bruno Lima Rocha, who joins us from Porto Alegre in Brazil. We also have activist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, who joins us from Los Angeles. I'd like to welcome you both. Ramiro Funes, let me first start with you. Looking at the parliamentary elections, the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, governing Socialist Party has regained control of the National Assembly. What does this mean for Venezuela, and what message does this send?
Thank you for having me on. The fact that President Nicolas Maduro and the United Socialist Party of Venezuela have won the legislative branch of Venezuela's government means that there will be less deadlock. Let's not forget that for the past few years, the National Assembly has been directly operated not just by the Venezuelan opposition, but has been directly taking orders from the U.S. government, USAID, NGOs that are intended to destabilize Venezuela, privatize its oil. And so all efforts for the past few years, what we've seen from the National Assembly, is attempts to deadlock any sort of progress made by the socialist government of Venezuela. This means that it makes it harder for the PSUV to bring food to working class people, to provide jobs, to elevate and construct the economy, which is from day one been the goal. Now that the National Assembly, the opposition, has been relegated to a more minor role, and that the Chavistas in power can actually do the things that they've been wanting to do, I think what we're going to see is that we're going to see more construction, more progress in Venezuela. We're going to see more public services. We're going to see less attempts by the opposition to destabilize, and I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Okay, well, Bruno, why don't you tell us why the West, EU and the U.S. Have described these elections as not being free and fair?
Well, first of all, they accuse Maduro's administration to not allowing for international observers to go forward and look what was going on in Venezuela. But I can't understand this measure, because Venezuela is under attack since so long time that they have to do their countermeasures against a coup d'etat, for example, that they suffered last April, last year. So they are alleging that the Venezuela election is not fair, but it's I would say it's hypocritical, because in 2013, the Carter Center said that Maduro was elected in a fair election, and the State Department said that Capriles was stolen. So whatever they do in Venezuela, the West, the UN, or at least the USA and the EU, they will say that they're not fair. I think that their goal is to destabilize Venezuela and not allowing Venezuela to do to convert their oil revenues in some kind of industrialization, and first of all, to be sovereign in food production, because unhappily, the state of Venezuela do not produce the whole food they need. This is a lack of Maduro's economy. This was a lack in Chavez's economy, and they must overcome this and be sovereign in food production.
Well, Ramiro Funes, the U.S. has obviously not acknowledged, nor confirmed, nor accept the results of these elections. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said that these elections were a, quote, political farce, which he said the U.S. condemns as a charade. Of course, the first question that comes to mind is, how can he say this when the U.S. presidential elections themselves have been called by some a charade?
That's exactly right. I mean, you compare the elections in Venezuela. First of all, let's acknowledge the fact that there have been more elections in Venezuela under the Bolivarian Revolution, which began in 1999 with the election of Hugo Chavez. There have been over 15 elections, countless, way more than the United States. And these are direct democratic elections. Venezuela is a democratic, direct republic. The United States is a representative republic, which is very different. In the United States, the people, what it really comes down to is the Electoral College, and we saw that play out in the battle between Trump and Biden, where the people don't really exercise political power. You have the marginalization of black and brown communities, of voters. In Venezuela, black, brown, indigenous people are given the power to vote. They're mobilized to vote. They're given the day off, first of all. And so what we see in Venezuela is more democracy. For the U.S. to go and claim that these elections were a sham is just ridiculous. And we really have to look at history to understand why this is nonsense. I mean, for example, you have the fact that in 1973, after the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile, who was a leftist president, they implemented Pinochet as a government. They had a farce election, which nobody participated in, and they called those democratic. The same thing in 2009 with the U.S. backed coup against Honduran President Manuel Zelaya. The military removed him from power. They had a sham election and imposed a right-wing military regime that still reigns. And in Bolivia, just last year, we saw that President Evo Morales, the first indigenous president, was removed from power for completely farcical reasons. The military again had a farcical election. The U.S. approved it, even though nobody participated. And the same thing. So we really have to keep this all with a grain of salt. One last thing on this point that I just want to mention is that the U.S., no matter what, it knows that these claims of election fraud are total nonsense. But the point is to stir trouble by any means. What the U.S. wants, just like in other countries, in Iran, in Russia, in China, in Venezuela, Nicaragua, what they want is destabilization. They want a lack of trust in the political system of that country to spur protests by any means. But the people of Venezuela do not want protests. They do not want uprisings. They want peace, stability, and prosperity.
Well, Bruno, if we want to take a look at perhaps the incoming U.S. administration headed by the president-elect Joe Biden, if confirmed or once confirmed, don't you think that it has lost some footing when you have the current president who doesn't accept the election results in the U.S., and yet you have the incoming president come to the table and then say, maybe, again, I'm asking your opinion here, what will it say, or what will the president-elect say, whoever he chooses to perhaps head any type of negotiations with Venezuela, and in particular Maduro?
Maybe. I would say that for us in Latin America, the Democrats are as bad as Republicans. I would quote, for example, Lyndon Johnson was vice president of John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was murdered, assassinated, and then they killed the one who killed John Kennedy, and they said that Brazil was under a communist threat and auxiliated the coup d'etat in Brazil in 1964. So from here, from Latin America, we can expect everything from the gringos, everything from the worst part of the gringos they come and they send to us. But I would say that Joe Biden maybe do some steps. For example, suspend some parts of the blockade, or at least allow CITGO to do operations in U.S. CITGO is one of the almost a dozen PDVSA subsidiaries who are under blockade also, and who are under a kind of, I would say, white list for prohibition. Maybe, for example, if they suspend partially the blockade of Iran, Iran may produce more oil together with Venezuela. the last thing that Venezuela would need now would be an escalation in the blockade, and an escalation to destabilize Venezuela. But I don't think so. I think that Joe Biden would be so-called multilateralist and so-called through the UN, and would not do a direct provocation against Venezuela. He may do this, but I don't know if for the first 6 months he will do some steps just like Mike Pompeo administration.
We need to discuss this a little bit further, since so much of the U.S. pressure on Venezuela has been exercised when we were viewing in so many different ways. But, of course, all eyes would be, again, once and if President-elect Biden gets confirmed, what type of approach he's going to have. One of the headlines that caught our attention here that I'm going to ask you if you think this will be the case is that Biden will herald a shift in U.S. strategy towards Venezuela. And it goes on to say that Biden now has a historic opportunity to lead an international coalition to promote a political solution for Venezuela. This coming from Juan Gonzalez, who advised Biden on Latin American issues. Now, do you think that that will be the case, or will we still see that maximum pressure being exercised on Maduro and Venezuela?
That's a great question. I mean, I think no matter what, the maximum pressure has been and will continue to be imposed against Venezuela since 1999, when Chavez was elected, but it takes different forms. I think what we saw for the past 3 years, I mean, last year and the year before that, we saw a failed coup attempt in Venezuela where they tried to support these uprisings. We saw a more hard-fist approach at the border as well with Colombia, where they tried to foment crisis and protest. And at one point, Trump was even threatening military escalation. And that is what the Trump and Republican and the Pentagon wing of the U.S. ruling class represents. They represent hard power. They want guns. They want ships. They want weapons to be sent directly. You know, we even had the mercenary attack last year where U.S. mercenaries were directly involved in trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government. I think what we're going to see is a shift over to the typical Democratic Party style of overthrowing color revolutions, quote-unquote peaceful pro-democracy protests. And we saw this happen time and time again under the Obama administration. For example, under Obama, it was revealed that the U.S. government was funding right-wing underground radio stations that are quote, pro-democracy in Cuba. We saw the Obama administration support a color revolution in Iran, the quote-unquote Green Revolution. They're going to continue this method because now the jig is up. People know that the United States for the past few years have been trying to go in and invade Venezuela directly, and they haven't been able to. And so now the U.S. ruling class is like, look, we need to figure out a better strategy to win a better PR for this regime change. The maximum pressure will continue, but it will now continue in the form of funding NGOs, trying to use soft power to control the Venezuelan people against developing a socialist economy.
Bruno, when you take a look at the U.S. and how it has gathered countries in Latin America to rally against Maduro, we could name other countries also. One of the ways that this has been done is the U.S. influence on the Organization of American States. Is that strategy going to still continue? Do you think under Biden, or right now, we're looking again at the U.S. power image that it had prior to have faded with the way that Trump handled things in general, and the standing that the U.S. has had has actually decreased? Do you think then perhaps Latin American countries, given this impression of the U.S., may have a different view on Maduro than ones who are against him?
I think, as I said before, maybe because the OEA, they had a ridiculous representation in the Bolivia crisis, and it was a so-called Frente Amplista from Uruguay who said that was a fraud in Bolivian election in 2019. And now Venezuela, they do have a chance to do another, I would say, arrow of alliance. First of all, with Bolivia and Cuba, their strategic allies, and then with more moderate relations, I would say, with Mexico and Argentina. So the OEA may not have a huge role to do in our continent, and we will feel this. For example, in the next Honduran election, when the State Department will be the first step to say that it was clean or not, because Honduran they have two frauds consecutive, and first the coup d'etat, as my colleague said, it was a goal for Hillary Clinton administration in the State Department. They also did under the Democratic Party a coup d'etat in 2012 in Paraguay and a coup d'etat here in Brazil. So I think that this momentum, this first six months, will be for the new administration of U.S. to observe the continent and to, realize what will be their policy. Bad news, they do have a gusano in the State Department, which is bad, so bad.
Well, one thing that it needs to do, let's talk about the challenges that really lie for Maduro now that he has won the parliamentary elections, his party, that is. And Ramiro, tell us, one of the biggest challenges that I see immediately is the fact that there needs to be legitimacy on Maduro himself. I mean, at this point, we're looking at 60 countries not recognizing him, but recognizing Guaido as the leader. And we could add, actually, the EU also, because we haven't mentioned how the EU seems like the EU is very fixated on Venezuela. They have come out and said that these elections, just like the U.S., are not free and fair. How can Maduro move forward to get his legitimacy in the first place and then move to try to fix some of the broken institutions, mainly economic ones, in order to push Venezuela forward?
I think President Nicolas Maduro is in a very tough situation because he has, as you mentioned, both divisions at home and abroad. For all transparency, I do support President Nicolas Maduro. I have some critiques, you know, of his administration, but overall, I think he's doing a pretty decent job at continuing the legacy of Hugo Chavez. However, one of the main issues in this election was a growing division between the Communist Party of Venezuela and the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, which is Maduro's party. There were actually some Communist Party members of Venezuela that were boycotting the PSUV, that were going against. And so one of the reasons for that is that many people in Venezuela feel that some of the socialist reforms are not being implemented fast enough. Now, here's the thing. The only way to implement socialist reforms is by building and developing the country. Socialism has to be built on abundance. And as I mentioned earlier, for the past two or three years, the National Assembly has made it almost impossible for the Venezuelan government to develop its economy. Thankfully, because of countries like Iran, like China, like Russia, and others, it's been able to lift more people out of poverty, but that's been very difficult to do. And so I think domestically, one way that Maduro can really unite, close ranks, and unite the Venezuelan people is to accelerate those socialist reform programs, nationalize more industries, bring more wealth and prosperity to the broad masses of people. Now, internationally, that's a different question. When we're talking about the European Union, the United States, no matter what, and it's not about Maduro, it's about the fact that it's a government by and for the people that uses the profits of its oil for its own people. Even if it wasn't Maduro, if it was someone else, if he talked more politely, if he dressed better, they would still attack him with the same stuff, because at the end of the day, he's hurting the profits. He's hurting the profits of the big oil companies that run the European Union, that run the United States. So no matter what, I think we're going to continue to get these same messages from the EU, from the United States. But at the end of the day, that also is becoming a little less relevant, because now you have the rise of countries across, especially the Eurasian continent, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkey, Iran, so many countries that are developing and creating a new multilateral world order where you don't have to rely on the U.S. and the EU anymore for their approval, because we can trade with Iran, we can trade with Kazakhstan, we can trade with China, and they're not going to try to tell us how to run our political system. And so I think while Maduro should definitely make efforts to close ranks at home, to re-radicalize the base around the Bolivarian project, I think no matter what, you know, the EU and the U.S. are going to keep talking against Maduro, but it's kind of irrelevant at this point.
Yes, but there is relevancy, and my final question goes to you, Bruno, that you need this country to be able to generate the income, and its number one commodity is oil. You have the U.S. Mm-hmm. that has been fixated on Venezuela. Many say because of the oil. Do you think that there will be a chance that sanctions will allow to be lifted, will allow Venezuela to generate income and then for the country to move forward? How do you see that future? If you can answer that in a minute.
Okay, that's the goal. That's a strategic goal. Venezuela has so many problems in economics. They have a problem in the smuggling economy. They have maybe 4 to 5 currencies inside the territory, and they must not be so dependent in oil trade. If there's sanctions, if the blockade is not relieved, I would say that they must do a kind of strategic alliance with the Eurasian power, as the colleague said. Otherwise, the people will be starving, and they won't produce the abundance that they do need to socialize profits and products. Unhappily, that's a reality. They need oil, and oil is a curse. If you only have oil is a curse.
Thank you for that. Let me thank our guest, Professor of International Studies at Unicinos, Bruno Lima Rocha, there talking to us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. Also, activist and political commentator Ramiro Funes, who spoke to us from Los Angeles. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Miko Etahwe, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the value of this world. Well, the world, this world, this very world that we live in is fake. It's an illusion. This whole world is a lie. And we live our lives trying our best to shun out this reality. Whether we admit it or not, our homes will eventually have new owners. Our cars will eventually become outdated. The girl we once dreamt of will become old. It's the nature of life, and the sooner we understand this, the less bitter we will feel once it leaves us. For it surely will leave us. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam promised us that this entire world was as worthless as the price of a defected goat that was dead. So why are we infatuated with the temporary home that we know we must eventually leave? Think of the most richest person on this planet Earth. When they died, were they able to take anything with them? What is it that they were able to take with them? All of those belongings, all of those luxuries, all of those attractions, all of this glamour, all of those cars, houses, I don't know, video games, phones, everything and anything. What were they able to take with them? And how long do you think they were able to enjoy all this? You know, if you just take into consideration a normal person's life, how long do you think they can avail all those facilities that they acquire in this life? So this world is an illusion. Remember this. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the value of this world. What is the worth of this world? You see, this world was meant to be the ground upon which we walk, yet we have left it creep into our hearts. We have fallen in love with something that will never love us back, and it will continue to break our hearts until we realize this painful truth. If you want happiness, and who doesn't want happiness? We all want happiness. We all want satisfaction. If you want happiness and joy and satisfaction and fulfillment, that true fulfillment, I make oath by Allah that there is no other way to find it except through Him. That is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the creator of the heavens and the earth. You get connected to that source of satisfaction, to that source of felicitation, to the source of happiness and joy and fulfillment, you start feeling fulfilled. You start feeling satisfied. You start feeling joyful. You start feeling cheerful. This world, on the other hand, is supposed to make you sad. Why do you think there are so many miseries in everybody's lives? Especially, I'm talking about those who do not connect with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the real creator. Why? They have money. And as a matter of fact, if you closely analyze, people who have more wealth, they are more disturbed in today's time and age. Seriously, we don't have time to go into details of what I just said, but think about it. People who have wealth, people who have resources, they are not satisfied with their lives. They take these medications that would put them to sleep because apparently their couch, their comfortable bed is not good enough for them. You see, Allah is the one who created love and happiness and has made it only possible through Him. When He says explicitly in Quran, "Verily in the remembrance of Allah do hearts find rest." Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.